Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 22nd day of April, 2022. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll explore just exactly what carbon sequestration might mean and how it works in farm fields. Well, in the soil in general. We'll start our conversation with Dr. Marshall McDaniel from Iowa State University.
Sure. My name is Marshall McDaniel. I'm a soil scientist in the agronomy department at Iowa State University, and I research soil-plant interactions, and I teach three courses.
I need you to teach us today. What is a carbon credit? What does that represent? And how is it related to soil carbon?
Yeah, so a carbon credit is simply a permit that allows the emission of 1 ton of CO2. And there's, as far as the credit goes, there's markets. There's kind of a compliance market, or where a government or federal agency might require the permits or accounting of it. And then the kind of the hot trend now is the voluntary markets or private markets that are selling permits.
Can you tell us a bit more about the research you're doing in regards to soil carbon and how that is part of the carbon markets?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so the research we conduct in my lab group kind of relates to the carbon market in three ways. One, we study novel ways to manage soils and plants in order to increase soil carbon. So some of these management practices that are being touted as ways to buy and or sell the carbon credits themselves. Also, we do research in how to accurately measure changes in soil carbon after what I like to call a management intervention, so a change in a management practice. And the reason why we need to study that is because depending on the soil type, the climate, other management factors, the speed of carbon accrual in the soil might be different, and we need to kind of accurately track that in order to verify some of these carbon markets. And then the third way that we do research in regards to this carbon market and soil carbon in general is exploring what I like to call early indicators of changes in soil carbon. And one of the early indicators that I often tout is the soil biology. Usually the soil biology is one of the first parameters or things that change in response to a management. And there's some ideas floating around out there that some of these changes in the biology in the soil might portend longer term changes in soil carbon.
Can you measure carbon very well? You mentioned you could working on tracking it. How hard is it?
Oh, geez, don't even get me started. It's really difficult even for a scientist. So measuring the carbon, and usually measuring it is easy, more or less. And I can walk you through kind of how we do it in a laboratory setting and in a field. But then actually giving confidence, or sometimes in as scientists, we say a significantly or significant increase, a statistical significant increase in soil carbon. That's a whole nother can of worms, pun intended. And the way that we do this is so the ideally you go out and you sample deep, which is a challenge for most agronomists. You have to have special equipment usually mounted to the back of a tractor or an ATV or a truck, and that allows you to sample deeper, usually more than 3 or 4 feet. And when you sample deep, you assess more of the soil's potential for soil carbon. So there's been a lot of research that's showing that we don't understand the impact of these management practices on deep carbon. And so this is something I think the carbon markets will struggle with, because it's not easy to sample deep, and usually only labs that have the capacity and some of that special equipment I mentioned can sample deep. And the other thing I want to mention about that, so that's just taking a soil sample. Then the sample comes back to a lab. We usually sieve it and remove plant particles and homogenize the soil. Then we dry it. Then we grind it down to homogenize it even more, and then we analyze it on a machine called an elemental analyzer, and that tells us the percent of carbon in that soil sample at a particular depth. But you also have to know the bulk density or the mass of soil per volume to calculate a total carbon stock. And that, I know that sounds complicated, and there's a lot going into that, but that there's a lot of error at every step of that process. And that's what makes it so challenging to measure a statistically significant increase in soil carbon. And on, to add to the complexity is that it, depending on where you measure in a field, there's high what we call spatial variability, or just differences in soil carbon that have nothing to do with the management, but that change from, you know, a sample taken 1 foot away from another. There's a high amount of variability in a field. So you have to sample frequently, usually to detect a signal in the noise, as sometimes we say. And then all of those steps add additional error, measurement error to it.
Does soil type matter?
Yes, yeah, soil type matters. And so soil type is a very broad term. I'm glad you brought that up. So one way to classify or type a soil is the landscape position. And we know the landscape position has a large effect on both the amount of carbon in a soil, but also a soil's capacity to accrue carbon. We published a study a couple years ago that showed this nicely. Actually, some of the more eroded hilltops, so kind of backslope and summits in the field, accrue carbon faster than depressions that already start at maybe a higher soil carbon levels, a higher organic carbon level. So that's one way to kind of answer your question about soil type. The other, so that's the landscape position as a way to type soils. But also we know that soils that are heavier textured, so have more clay, those are store different amounts of carbon than a sandier soil. And by different, I mean the clayer soils, the finer textured soils, typically can hold more carbon. So they have I like to use the analogy of a jar. So they already have a larger jar that can be filled with than a sandier soil, kind of has a smaller jar or bank that can be filled, even if you're doing all the practices right and kind of reach a soil carbon saturation is the term that sometimes we use as scientists, or soil carbon capacity.
Is it related to water holding capacity? And if so, does tiling make a difference?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. It does. So there have been a few studies, and some of them have shown a bit of controversy. But I think most of the science now is falling on the side of that when you increase soil organic matter and soil carbon. So just to be clear here, soil organic matter is about 50% carbon. So there's other elements that make up organic matter. But when you increase carbon and organic matter, it usually increases the amount of water that a soil can hold. But it also has other benefits to it as well that we sometimes we call co-benefits to increasing the soil carbon. So as carbon increases, so does organic matter and the other nutrients that are paired with that carbon. So nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur are usually elements that also are increasing if you're increasing your soil carbon generally.
Back to soil types just for a bit. So geography, landscape makes a difference. Water holding capacity makes a difference. We usually think of soil types of like Ipava and Flanagan and such. Does that make a difference?
As in the soil series, like Flanagan. So I did my master's at the University of Illinois, so I do know those are soil series names out in Illinois. That soil series name is just another way to type soils, right? And so the series will have different, and it's also based on landscape position. That's actually one of the more important factors, but texture also changes with the soil series. So yes, to answer your question, yes, all of those things play a big role in a soil's capacity to store carbon, but also to accrue it and how fast it accrues.
All right. So this is an oddball question, but if you were going to purchase farmland to store carbon, where would you do it?
That's an interesting question. It actually would depend on the history of that soil too. So again, if you think of the analogy of like a jar or a bank account, a lot of research has shown that poor soil management has depleted about 50% of soil organic matter, soil carbon, prior to Euro-American cultivation in the Midwest. So if you were to find a soil that was very poorly treated and was even lower than 50% of the kind of maximum that jar or bank can hold, then you would be storing more carbon in it. So, but you know, that soil, I don't think that'd be a good financial choice because that soil probably also doesn't grow crops on it very well.
Yeah, it'd be a worn out soil. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you explain the different ways to measure carbon for carbon markets?
There are two ways to answer that question, Todd. Either the companies will pay for performance or pay for practice. And pay for performance actually requires either monitoring, verification of the practice and that it's actually increasing soil carbon. Then there's also the option of paying for practice. And this means we just know generally that a practice like no-till increases soil carbon on average, you know, half a ton of carbon per hectare per year. And then they pay regarding that practice, no matter what the measured soil carbon gain is in the field. However, most of the companies that I'm seeing in the carbon market space are using one or more of the following modeling. So using mathematical models that are complex and involve a lot of physico-chemical processes and climate and everything, and soil type that we discussed earlier, remote sensing. So some companies are using remote sensing and soil sampling or a combination of those three. But those are the kind of three ways they're tracking payments and that go to farmers.
So did you just tell me that if I've been a no-tiller for 30 years that I have stored 15 tons of carbon and that's in the banks more or less, which might be valuable?
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the controversies around these carbon markets. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, so that has been one of the worries. And there are a few companies that will pay for past performance, usually, or past practices, let's say maybe 5 or 10 years, I think most companies that do this are just about 5 years prior. They'll pay you if you've been doing no-till all this time. Otherwise, the term that's often thrown around is perverse incentives. So you might, if you were a farmer and you just wanted to consider, or you're concerned with carbon markets, you could, you know, till your soil for a few years and then go back into no-till and maybe lose some of those gains you had made prior to the carbon markets just to enter the carbon markets with a tilled soil, for example. I think that's what you're asking.
Well, no, I get why you would do that. I was just thinking that if it was more or less like a savings account that you've been putting money into and fine, it's been, or a CD, and it's coming due more than it, right? And so that if it's been banked for 30 years, that it might be worth something as opposed to I could rip it up, let it all go, and then start to build it back in order to free up space in my jar, essentially.
Oh, yeah, sorry. That's the perverse incentive I was talking about. That's kind of some of the,
right.
Some of my economics colleagues call a perverse incentive, right? That idea. And we do think, so this gets to another issue. We do think that there is a finite carrying capacity of carbon for many soils. There are some exceptions to that, and there are management practices that might kind of exceed that carrying capacity, but we think that practices like no-till and cover crops and many other practices eventually, And we don't know how long that is, and it depends on the soil and climate and many other factors, but they do reach a limit where you might not be getting gains in carbon anymore, although that's not to speak of all the gains you get in maybe water quality or, you know, reduced erosion, increased infiltration rates that kind of come along with increasing your soil carbon too.
Yeah, so you talked a little bit about soil health right there as a role that soil carbon can play. Maybe you can expand on that and discuss compaction if it's related to soil carbon as well.
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. So do you remember the transitive properties in your math class?
No.
So, yeah, I ask farmers when I'm giving talks about this, so this is one of the analogies I use. So the transitive properties is where if A is like B and B is like C, then A is also like C, right? And so the reason I bring up this transitive properties, because I think there's transitive properties of soil carbon and soil health, right? So soil carbon is what the companies want to track, but that's related to soil organic matter. So if you remember, I mentioned soil organic matter is about 50% carbon. And when you're increasing that carbon, you're also increasing nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and increasing water holding capacity of the soil. A lot of research has shown. And those things we call ecosystem services, soil ecosystem services. And that to me is what soil health is all about. Soil ecosystem services are the functions that soils provide that enable life on Earth and benefit human beings and the rest of life on planet Earth. So supplying nutrients to crops, holding water, infiltrating water, a habitat for soil organisms. Those are all aspects of soil health that I think fall under these ecosystem services. And to relate it back to that transitive properties, you know, if you're increasing soil carbon, you're also increasing organic matter. You're generally increasing those soil ecosystem services, which are all just a part of and examples of soil health, like you just mentioned, the infiltration, the increased infiltration, greater water holding capacity, greater ability to supply nutrients to plants. And, you know, it's not always a straight line through those, but there is a lot of connection between it. And there's some examples where it's not exactly a straight line to performance of crop productivity and increase in carbon. But those are the things we're really exploring as scientists, connecting these, the trade-offs and the benefit and the co-benefits of increasing carbon.
Any advice for a producer, a farmer, a landowner that's interested in carbon markets or in implementation of carbon storage?
Sure. I think it would be the same advice a lawyer would have for anybody. Read the contract. We have a couple extension faculty that work in the economics department here that I work with at Iowa State. And we've got some documents that I'm happy to provide people if they send me an email or they look at the Iowa State University Extension store. And one of the advice a lot of my colleagues in the economics department talk about is, you know, make sure you read the contract, because each of these companies has kind of different clauses in their contracts. Some of them want soil sampling, but they want the farmer to pay for it. So just knowing everything that goes on in those contracts is really important. It's just like anything in life. You're buying a new house or getting a loan for a house. You want to make sure you read the contract. And I'm happy to help out anybody who's interested in this and pointing them to the information if I don't have it. And yeah, you can reach out to me at Iowa State or some of my colleagues in the Iowa State University Extension store.
Marshall McDaniel is a professor and soil scientist at Iowa State University in Ames. We've been talking with him about carbon sequestration and how carbon really is sequestered in soils. Now let's turn our attention to some work that the University of Illinois has been doing. Researcher and PhD student Sarah Sellers introduces herself.
Okay. Hi, my name is Sarah Sellers. I'm a third year PhD student here at University of Illinois in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics. My advisor is Dr. Gary Schnittke. I grew up here in Illinois on a family farm outside of Winchester, Illinois. And I kind of got involved in agricultural carbon markets when I helped to put together a FarmDoc Daily article called What Questions Should Farmers Ask About Selling Carbon Credits last year. And then things kind of took off from there. So we've been doing a lot of extension presentations and webinars, trying to get some information out there to help farmers navigate this decision.
Well, tell me a little bit about the research and what you know about carbon markets.
So right now we've been working on compiling some extension information and putting together some materials to help farmers navigate carbon markets and decide whether they even want to enter the carbon market. So we have two FarmDoc Daily articles, What Questions Should Farmers Ask About Carbon Credits and Growing Climate Solutions Act Impact on Farmers. We have a YouTube playlist on carbon markets that's on the FarmDoc Daily YouTube channel. We have an extension presentation we've been giving. And we also did a FarmDoc webinar not too long ago on carbon markets. So that's a little bit about what we've been working on. And things have changed a lot since we've been working on this extension project too. So it's really interesting to see how all of this carbon market stuff is kind of evolving.
Do you have an assessment of upcoming trends and maybe some of the impacts?
So one thing we've been keeping a really close eye on is the policy side of things, because I think this has potential to really impact the carbon markets. So there's been a lot of questions around, will the USDA get involved? What would that involvement look like? There's the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which passed through the Senate, but it's still in the House. So I think if that ends up getting passed, it could have a big effect on what happens with the carbon markets. I think price is a big thing to keep an eye on and something a lot of people are talking about. I mean, it's important, especially from the farmer side of things. But I think there's some expectation from the company side that the price is going to go up. So, for example, Indigo, their prices in 2020, they're guaranteeing a minimum of $10 per carbon credit. In 2021, they were guaranteeing a minimum of $15 per credit, and now they're projecting that to go up to 30. And then Corteva, they also have a chart on their website that kind of projects what they think carbon credit payments are going to do in the future, all the way up to 2030. So I think it's really interesting. I think that's one thing to keep an eye on is what is the expectation out there that these companies think is going to happen. That doesn't necessarily mean that I think the price is going up or that I'm promoting that, but I think kind of the expectation and the feel in the market is maybe that the price is going to keep going up per carbon credit.
If you'd like to read the carbon markets articles that Sarah Sellers has written for the FarmDoc Daily website, you can do that at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand. Just click and play from willag.org, willag.org. There you'll find not only our daily agricultural programming, but updated information each and every day from the agricultural economist, plant scientist, and animal scientist from the University of Illinois. You can find it right now, in fact, willag.org. And if you want to, you can listen to our podcast using the podcast page and subscribe there. Just click the subscribe button in your favorite podcast and pick one of your favorite podcast applications. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.